Take me back to the old Dixie. That's the only little old place for little.
Hello, and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
But we only love books that were not written by white southerners in the 1950s.
Yes, much to the disappointment of the cast of this novel.
Yeah. Atticus Finch would not agree with us.
As it turns out. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
Maybe
we'll have a lot to say about him later.
Yeah. I was gonna say, this is the rare book where our spoiler policy is probably necessary to mention, though I think the main spoiler based on internet and Twitter headlines is already very much spoiled. But we do prefer to talk about the entire content of the books that we do on this podcast, so we're not going to hold anything back just because the book's only been out for a couple weeks and lots of people haven't read it yet.
Yeah, so if you haven't read the book and you don't want to be spoiled, then you should probably turn off the podcast right about now.
Yep, come back and read it, come back after you've read it, rather. And I'm sure by now you already know that Atticus Finch is a segregationist in this book, but there it is.
Yeah, sometimes. I kept hoping he was going to end up being a pretend racist, but no dice. He's just straight up racist.
Yeah, well, these things happen. Disillusionment, Gabs, it's like a theme and such.
Yeah, totally. In life as well as in this novel.
Yeah. So I guess before we really get into the book, we just wanted to make a quick shout out to new fan Anthony.
Yeah, he dropped a comment on the website. He's been tweeting at me, and I appreciated it because he said we were both funny, but I was especially funny.
Which honestly is just true. So the comment he left on novelideaspodcast.com, where you can all leave comments if you want us to read them, is, "Just discovered podcast literally today and love it. You two really have me a few chuckles, especially when you curse. Lol, heard Lord of the Flies episode, and I was a tiny bit bummed you didn't mention title in reference to Bible story about God Baal and how parents would sacrifice their young. The statue would literally be covered with flies because of blood, so it looked like people were worshipping flies." Two things. First of all, that is an interesting fact. Second of all, we had no idea that was a fact because we don't actually do any research for this podcast.
Yeah, I read that comment and I was like, wow, like if we had known that, we should have mentioned that. That's like really cool, Bible reference. But yeah, we didn't actually know if that was a reference because we didn't do any research, so...
And again, because we didn't do any research, I'm going to ask a question out loud that I don't know the answer to, but was Baal one of the Carthaginian gods, too?
Oh, I don't know.
The whole blood and worship thing, this made me curious.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anywho, as you can see, our research standards are low, so that's why.
Thanks anyway, Anthony.
Indeed, that was interesting to learn. All right, so if you haven't figured it out already, the book we read this time was Go Set a Watchman by Harper Lee.
Yes, not by Truman Capote.
Or Since I Was Hanging Out with Tony Last Night, not by Francis Bacon. That's a Shakespeare joke for those of you who haven't heard all of our episodes. This is a pretty significant cultural book right now, as it was recently published. It was, you know, it's a, I guess you would say, companion more than sequel or prequel, maybe, to To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, like, technically, given the time frame, it's a sequel because it takes place, I think, about 20 years after To Kill a Mockingbird. But Harper Lee wrote it first, so it's kind of in an odd in-between space. And Ben and I, for that matter, aren't really even convinced that these two books exist on the same timeline, so...
Yeah, I think the continuity is not direct. It's almost like a... closely parallel universe.
She's exploring what would happen if this. It's like a really elaborate alternate universe fan fiction.
Yeah, there you go.
Written by the author of the book that it's a fan fiction of.
Right. So we're going to talk about the publication of this book just a little bit for a minute here. Because it was actually written before To Kill a Mockingbird, even though it's been published, what, like 50 years later?
Yeah. Yeah, so the big controversy behind this book, or the story behind it, is that it was the first book Harper Lee wrote. She sent it into the publisher. They loved the flashbacks and said, oh, hey, instead of this book, why don't you write a book based around Scout's childhood? And we don't know exactly if they had seen trial scenes in Ghost of a Watchman and told her that specifically, or if she came up with that or what. But she went off and wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, and they worked on that and published that instead. And then for years and years and years, she said, I don't want to publish my first book. It's not really there. Like, good enough. We'll just live with To Kill a Mockingbird. And now she is, I think she's 89 or 90, and her sister Alice was her power of attorney, and her sister died, I think, last year, and then they found the manuscript to this book in her stuff last fall, I think late last fall.
Man, they really got it out quickly.
Yeah, they published it this year, so it's been kind of a sticking point for a lot of people, because if Harper Lee didn't want it published for so many years, and now she's 90 and needs power of attorney because, you know, she's a little too old to take care of all of her own affairs, how behind the book is she really? Did she get pressured into it? People have been debating a lot whether or not the book even should have ever been published in the first place.
Yeah, and I mean, financially, it's undoubtedly been successful for her estate, really, at this point. It's definitely a gray area. I suppose that in a couple more, if they'd found this manuscript, then in a couple more years, when, because it seems pretty likely that's what it's going to be at age 90 when she passes away. Maybe they would have published it anyway, but we'll get into more of the book-related details, obviously. You can tell that it's not as polished a product, so from a quality control standpoint, I can definitely see where she'd be, would have been coming from for all these decades.
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, publishing books after authors die, I think, is kind of a thing. Emily Dickinson, for sure, they published stuff of hers after she died. I think they published Franz Kafka's stuff after he died, even though he wanted all of his writing burned. So it's pretty common after a literary figure dies to just start publishing their stuff. And I'm kind of surprised they didn't just wait for her to do it. There would have been less, I think, controversy, because post-publishing stuff posthumously, then you don't have to worry about what they think about it, but
right, and the fact that we're, that those of us who are not in her immediate family and friends, I suppose, don't really have a good idea of what her facilities actually are at this point, so
yeah,
that makes it another question, right?
Yes, because a lot of people are convinced there's this big conspiracy where she's not of sound mind, but then the, you know, her attorney and the people who see her claim, no, she is, and she gave us her blessing on publishing it, so it's just been a huge mess.
All right, then. So let's move along to the actual book.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, like we said, a sort of sequel, even though it was written first, to Kill a Mockingbird. I think it's fair to say a classic that probably like 98% of people had to read in school.
To Kill a Mockingbird?
Yeah, To Kill a Mockingbird, right.
Not this book.
Not this book.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever talked to anyone who didn't have to read To Kill a Mockingbird in school. At least in the U.S.
Well, right. Because it's certainly a resonant book if you're a citizen of the United States. Just given our history and our culture, and for that matter, kind of like the semi-divided culture between North and South that even still exists to some degree in 2015.
Yep.
And so, you know, this book in some ways is, in broad strokes only, not in details, similar to To Kill a Mockingbird. It's, you know, it's kind of a coming-of-age story again, though it's a coming-of-age story for a 26-year-old instead of a however old Scout was in To Kill a Mockingbird. 7, 8, something like that?
Six? Yeah, something like that.
It is in the category, the somewhat nebulous category of Southern Lit, which seems to be a book set in the South written by a Southern person.
Yeah, but it's more in the category of, like, Southern Classic Lit as opposed to, like, the Southern Gothic Lit tradition.
Right.
Just kind of very straightforward. It almost feels like, when Ben and I were outlining yesterday, I actually compared it to The Help several times for anyone who's read that book and knows the controversy of that book. But it kind of feels like a modern-day adult novel about a young woman realizing things about the world, which is a fairly common type of book to write.
Yeah, it's probably one of the most common book plots is a young person finding out something about the world.
Yeah.
In certain genres, it's the only plot thread, really. So,
right, but not every book feels like it could be part of Oprah's book club.
Right.
I think this one does.
I think that's a good way to describe it. So I think we have a couple of plot synopses for this one.
Yeah, so my plot synopsis is everyone is more worried about the opinions of an old white man than the people being subjugated.
And the actually, I think the other one was your suggestion, too, but it was Scout finds out racism exists. Again. One of the reasons this is not a direct sequel is because apparently Scout forgot that racism existed in the 20 years intervening.
We're kind of surprised by that one.
Yeah.
The first plot synopsis is actually more of a commentary on the people reading the book. I've been kind of poking around online, and I think a solid point to be made about this book is that everyone's freaking out about Atticus Finch, but then a bunch of other people are like, well, I mean, he is an old white dude living in the South at that time. Like, how surprised are you really? And why are we more concerned about him than, you know, the actual treatment of black people in the South in the 1950s?
Right. Or, for that matter, why are we so focused on Atticus when he's on maybe 10% of the pages?
Also that.
He's a secondary character, for sure.
I don't know, I think we're kind of having a cultural moment where everyone is kind of like Scout.
Yeah, there
having,
you go.
Like, their god come crashing down on them.
Beloved literary figure.
Yep.
You know, people name their dogs after him and such.
Like me.
So
just to give you guys a brief summary really quick in case you haven't read it, there's not too much plot, so I don't think you'll get too confused, but Scout's in her mid-20s, she comes home to make home for 2 weeks like she does every year. She is sort of dating / sort of engaged to this guy named Hank, who she knew from her childhood, and her dad has arthritis now, so he can't get around as well as he used to. And while she's in town, she finds out that Hank and Atticus are both attending these basically segregationist meetings in town, and has this huge crisis of faith because she always thought Atticus would be someone who stands up for what's good, and she can't believe that he's a racist, and she freaks out, and then finally she confronts both Hank and Atticus about it, and essentially realizes that, or her uncle tries to impart upon her that she's now realized that she and her dad can believe different things, but that doesn't mean that she should abandon them.
Yeah.
The family, not her conscience.
Right.
So, pretty straightforward. And then there's some fun little flashbacks to her childhood and her teen years.
Yeah, and you can see why the publisher would have liked them, because they're quite charming.
They are.
Much like To Kill a Mockingbird, this story takes place in Macomb, Alabama, again.
Mm-hmm.
It's now 20 years later, so it's now the 1950s. It's even though the decision is not mentioned by name, it's pretty clearly, pretty closely on the heels of the Brown v. Board of Education ruling by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, they make references to, what did you think about the Supreme Court decision? But then because they keep talking about segregation, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah. And so, again, the protagonist is Scout, though this time 26 instead of 6. And one thing that is different this time around is that the story is told from a third-person perspective, mostly close on to Scout, rather than a first-person narration like in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, and actually, when I started reading the book, I thought this made it lose a little bit of personality to me. Books written in the third person can definitely get very close to the person they're following, but because the first one is Scout thinking about her childhood, and this one, again, feels a lot more like kind of the genre of Southern Lit, where it's like, oh, you know, here's Scout, and let me tell you about some of the wacky people in Macomb and stuff like that. It doesn't feel as personal to her for at least the first chunk of it.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe even later on a little bit, all of that emotional crisis she goes through later, and some of that may have been more of an editing issue than a perspective, point of view type of issue, but later when Scout is having her, holy cow, everything I knew is wrong, the world is upside down stuff, gets really tedious after about 2 pages.
Well, the one thing you have to keep remembering about this book is we don't know how much it was edited, but we think it can't be very much because it was a first draft as far as we know, and Harper Lee's not really in a place to do any edits or rewrites at this point in time, so they can't really have done that much to it. So I tend to think a lot of its flaws probably come from the fact that it is a book that is in need of some editing and just never got it.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably true. And, you know, the things we've, both things we've read for the podcast and certainly things I've read outside of the podcast, when you read an author who has a really good, polished work, or several of them, when you go back and read the first thing they wrote, even when it's just the first thing they published, as opposed to the first thing they actually wrote, because I think most
Which
of the time we don't get to read it. Yeah. If you're big enough, then sometimes it ends up getting published anyway.
Yeah.
Because they'll be like, hey, what else do you have lying in a... what are you sitting on an old hard drive somewhere, or lying in a trunk in the basement? Well, I have this piece of shit. Well, now that you know how to write, maybe you could rewrite it slightly so it sucks less. but those early attempts always, pretty much always read like a rougher, earlier attempt at writing a book, because
oh, yeah,
writing a good book is hard, man.
And that's actually kind of funny, just to bring up Shakespeare really quick, is I recently read Titus Andronicus for the first time, which is the first tragedy he ever wrote and one of the earliest plays that he wrote, and you can actually totally see how he wasn't as good as he was in his later stuff, so...
Well, there
you go. Guys, even Shakespeare got better as he wrote more.
So that's kind of the standard for English literature, right? If even Shakespeare struggled early on, then all of us are allowed to.
Yeah. Even Harper Lee. Even and Harper actually, Lee. One of the things I really appreciate about Ghost at a Watchman, even though the book itself is not great, is one of the reasons people think Truman Capote wrote To Kill a Mockingbird is because they're always like, how can someone's first book be so good and so accomplished? I'm like, well, it wasn't her first book. Ghost at a Watchman was her first book, and it's not that good. And then clearly she worked with someone and got a little better and wrote a better book.
That's true. And for that matter, for all we know, there could have been a couple of manuscripts that were written and destroyed before Ghost at a Watchman, which is just the first one she was brave enough to send to a publisher.
Yeah, for real.
Because I think I had read somewhere that most authors don't actually manage to get published until around their seventh attempt at a novel, something like that.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
Sounds about right, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you need to spend, I don't know how many hours go into writing a novel.
A lot.
Right, I mean, it depends a lot on who you are and how ambitious the book is, right?
Yeah.
Because some people can throw down, I mean, I've read author blogs where they say, oh, you know, it takes a while to get it set up, but once I have it down, I can write the last 60,000 words in, like, 2 weeks, and it's like, Jesus. And then someone like, it was in the intro to a Joe Haldeman collection, he wrote that on a really good work day, he gets about 150 usable words down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he's obviously on the other extreme, where he's a very slow writer.
Yeah.
So it takes, so it takes him about 2 years, two plus years to write a novel at that rate.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you put a lot of hundreds or thousands of hours into writing before you are good enough to actually write something that other people might want to give you money for.
Yes. Unless there are some special cases. But yes, overall, yes.
Right. So all of that is really just us riffing on the idea that this is a less polished book and we shouldn't be surprised by that. So this book opens with Scout returning to Macomb, whatever.
I don't know.
from New York City, because that's where all, in literature, that's where all people from small towns go to be exposed to the wider world, because outside of your small town you grow up in, the only place the rest of the world exists is apparently New York City.
Yeah, I laughed when I heard that the book was based around her returning home from New York City. I was just like, why? Everyone goes to New York City.
It's like there are other big cities. It could be L.A., which in a movie happens sometimes, but in books is not a popular location.
I actually did read one book where this family lived on this small farm in Missouri, and one of the daughters went to Kansas City. And I was like, all right! But then I found out the author was from Kansas City, and I was like, well.
Well, there you go.
that's the only reason.
But Gabs, don't you know, it's because all of these authors and writers and directors want to make New York, like, a character in the story.
Yeah, whatever. I know people who live in New York still think it's like the only city in the entire world that exists, but
there's got to be, like, I would think if you were training people how to do film criticism, if, like, one of the first rules would be, if you write that New York City is like a character in the movie, then you don't deserve your job anymore.
Then you're fired. Go find a better movie.
It's become such a tiresome cliche. Or how about the Southern girl going to, like, live in Atlanta? That's a pretty big city.
For Scout's purposes, going north is good because, like, the whole thing centers around that north versus south. So
right.
She kind of had to be in a northern city, but agreed.
Yeah, just or like, throwing some ideas around, that's all.
Yeah. Centered in Nashville, she's going to become a country star.
There you go. Struggling to come up with words that rhyme with Atticus.
It's hard. We sing about our dog a lot. There's not that much.
Scout is essentially still the Scout that I think everybody came to know and love from To Kill a Mockingbird. She's still kind of, quirky, and she's direct in a way that's slightly socially awkward sometimes, and I think we're supposed to think that she still wears her tomboyishness from her childhood to a certain degree, even as an adult.
Yeah, I like that she specifically wears pants into town to piss off her aunt.
Yes. Some of the descriptions of her aunt were excellent.
Yeah.
Just talking
about, that's true.
Talking about, like, her, without directly saying it, talking about her size, especially, like, she used words to describe her aunt that would apply more to, like, a battleship than a human being.
Putting a corset around a battleship.
Yeah, and then the idea of, wondering if she even wore a corset to bed.
The ongoing battle there is pretty good. And Scout's other thing, you know, she... Oh, I'm going to say something that's just going to make me want to punch my own self in the face. She kind of feels like a millennial in some ways, because she's 26, and so by Southern standards, by her hometown standards, she should have been married and having kids by now. And she's pretty unsure if she wants to get married, and she's, pretty lukewarm on the whole kids idea, and... She's just not really sure if she wants to come back home, and trying to figure all that stuff out at a time when you assume, or when people are supposed to have figured it out, but when in truth no one has actually figured it out. So I kind of liked that about her, that she was still relatable to a modern day. Like, I'm only a year older than her in this book, so I was like, I get you.
Yeah, so I mean, She wasn't coming home in search of, I guess, some ideal life or some taste of ideal life or to... I mean, I think even though the book kind of develops so that she has issues with Macomb by the end because of, racism...
Yeah.
It's also not really a story about, oh, this is a backwards place and you should tuck your tail and run back to New York as quickly as possible.
Yes. She still had ties there. She still felt the pull of living there.
Yeah, I mean, that's maybe kind of the background for her, for a lot of her inner conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Because she does feel ties to this place. And I think even at the end, she's not entirely opposed to the idea of living in Macomb again eventually. Who was saying it? Come back because we need more people who think like you here.
Uncle Jack, actually.
Yeah, that's who it was.
Said that. Yeah. I thought that was an interesting thing for him to say.
Yeah. Why don't we move along here? We referenced Alexandra, Aunt Alexandra already. She's just the, basically avatar of the proper Southern lady from that time period.
Yeah. And she's also that breed of Southern lady that's kind of like... going extinct at that time because she's, older. So
right.
She's kind of the old school, but yeah, loves hosting teas and is in her element gossiping at church and is constantly scolding Scout for not wearing the proper clothing while going into town, stuff like that.
Yes, and taking offense when someone swears in her presence.
Yes. Not allowed to swear in her presence. And so I wouldn't last very long.
No.
There.
There's a little bit of... I think a little bit of... Certain of those attitudes have lasted even closer to today. I think because our grandmother went to such great lengths to avoid actually saying any of the swear words despite expressing their sentiment.
That's true, and our grandmother was not a proper Southern lady either, so she didn't even have that societal hang-up going on.
Right, though she definitely did think of herself as a lady. Whether or not that's true is perhaps up for debate beyond the scope of this podcast. But that idea of, you know, a polite, cultured person doesn't say certain things certain ways.
Mm-hmm. And I guess there's still some of that, but there's less of it in people, younger people.
Yeah, well, we've found a new set of taboos for that kind of stuff, I think would be how I would put it. You know, certain words that even when I was in high school were flung around all the time, if you used them in public now, you would go through the Twitter shaming and public apology cycle, for sure.
Good point. So not so much focus on being a lady or gentleman, but just, you know, in order to be a moral member of society or a good person, then you can't fling around certain phrases. I think that's true.
I think it's for sure true. That's one of the reasons I go back and listen to all these episodes all the way through instead of just trimming the silences to make sure there's nothing in there that we have to worry about. And for the record, so far I haven't had to trim one of us accidentally saying something racist, for example.
I'm not that surprised by that.
I'm just saying, you never know. So anyway, I think Alexandra is in some ways the best representation of the like mindset of Maycomb that Scout finds so offensive, despite the fact that Alexandra's not the one actually saying the stuff.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. Alexandra's kind of the typical Maycomb person.
So, I guess we should move along. So, Atticus.
Atticus. Yeah, so for anyone who doesn't know, I did name my dog after Atticus. Also because apparently ancient Roman dogs used to be named Atticus, so I thought that was sweet.
Yeah, that's...
But the Atticus, I think we all think we know from To Kill a Mockingbird, is a man very interested in doing right. He doesn't seem to have a lot of the hang-ups other Southerners have in that book, because Scout will come and say, so-and-so said this about you or about me, and he's like, well, don't worry about that. That's not a bad thing to be. So I think Scout and everyone who read that book got this idea of him kind of being this oasis of good. And in this book, he kind of brings that crashing down, because we realize that even though he still does good stuff, it's not because he is an anti-racist person who believes in equality. And the way they end up kind of explaining it away, because Scout gets really hung up on the fact that he defended Tom Robinson in the first book, and she thought he was doing it out of a sense of, you know, equality and all this other stuff. And I guess what was really going on is because Tom was innocent, Atticus was so offended by the injustice of the law that he had to step up to help him out, and that was really more of his main motivation. But then, on the other hand, he has this kind of Southern gentleman thing going on where he wants to protect the ideas and ways of the South, which means believing that white people are better on a higher plane, I guess that she should say, than the black people. And it's interesting because he tries to believe that in, like, the nicest way possible, I would say. Like, his motivations for his racism are so frustrating because he's not just straight up, I hate them. He's more like, well, we have to look at them and realize that they're just not quite ready to be given the same rights as us. So they just need some help in that. And then maybe eventually they can be raised up a little bit and given some more rights. And so he's frustrating because he thinks he's being logical.
Right. The word paternalistic comes to mind.
Yeah. But he's totally just doing that asshole-y southerner thing where he's like, oh, well, all black people are really children, even if they're adults, so they're not responsible enough to vote and own land and, you know, be people.
Yeah, which is... which is an attitude that probably was... pretty common, but we would which we would consider to be not all that gentle and pretty straight up racist in today's society.
I was gonna say if you've read history, that is a very common sentiment, and I think the most obvious way to kind of show it is that it was very common in the South for white people to call all black people, like, men, for example, boy, even if they were, like, a 70-year-old grandfather, because they just thought, oh, they're all children, so they were all called boy, even if they were adults. And that's like, Atticus's point of view.
Yeah, and so, I mean, he's, his interest in justice is letter of the law, right?
Yes.
If he was a gamer, he'd be a rules lawyer. So I guess in real life he's a real lawyer, right? here's a better gaming metaphor. So the lawful good alignment for your character is one where you live by rules of law, but you can still do things that other characters would consider bad. Because you're following whatever your code is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... I think that's very much what Atticus's justification is for defending a black man who is probably wrongfully accused, despite not thinking that black man should be allowed to vote.
Yeah.
So, on the other... I guess on the other side of things a little bit... some of the good qualities of Atticus, some of the things that made him such a memorable and beloved character were present in this book still. His kind of quiet, slightly detached amusement at the rest of the world at times is still there.
His Mr. Bennett-esque attitude now that I think about it.
Very much so. and, I mean, even that Scout has her big blow-up and huge rant and even goes full Godwin's Law and compares him to Hitler.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. she does all of that, and he just takes it, and then when they talk again a couple scenes later, he basically says, no, that's what you thought. You were right to blow up at me, and we still don't agree on this, but that doesn't mean that we're not still family and that you shouldn't follow your conscience just because it's different than mine. Which,
yeah, I think he like respects her for actually standing up for herself.
Yeah, very much so. He actually said he'd been waiting for it for a few years now.
Yeah, and that's what makes Atticus really frustrating. I think maybe one of the points that Harper Lee is trying to get across is that a lot of these Southerners who were segregationists and racists were not necessarily what you would think of, like, as a typical Hollywood racist who was just, like, a shitty person all around. They had good qualities, too. But it's just really frustrating when it comes through in this literary figure that you don't want to have that shitty racist side.
Well, right, because, I mean, this book and some books that have been written with the... some books have been written with the perhaps objective of highlighting some of these racial inequalities have just gone ahead and demonized the racist side. And so being disillusioned because this guy who has been so awesome and so looked up to turns out to have this pretty hideous viewpoint. And then it's like, oh, but when it's just person to person, he's still the same awesome seeming guy. That's a struggle, because you want to just want to paint him as either black or white. Though that's probably the wrong turn of phrase to use here. You want to put him in a cubbyhole and define him, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I personally would, if I was Scout, I'd be like, okay, I get it. We have a difference of opinion. You are not going to hate me now because I have a different opinion, but ooh, I would still have a hard time being around my family after that.
Yeah, if it turned out...
It's a little bigger of a difference of opinion than other things you could disagree on.
Right. It's not like, we should adjust the tax rate slightly.
Yeah.
We have a political disagreement. Or, you know, you like this candidate and I like this candidate. If you really thought, if you had a strong moral position on an issue and found out that one of your family members, especially when in this case, I mean, her closest family member, the most important person in her life, like the one important moral issue of the day thinks opposite of how she thinks, that would be really hard just to set aside. And it's tough to even come up with a solid equivalent.
I was actually thinking, maybe to a lesser degree, but maybe if you equated it to gay marriage, since that's like a recent big thing, and you had a family member who all of a sudden is like, yeah, gay people don't deserve rights, and you'd be like, oh God.
Yeah, it would kind of color all of your future interactions for at least a period of time.
Yeah.
And I know for some reason some people get really angry when you compare gay rights to race rights. I don't know why, but I do think there are parallels there for sure.
Yes, and I guess you could always hope that they would eventually turn around and realize that they were being dicks.
It does seem like the type of moral issue where experience and reason could eventually lead you to change your mind, but that's changing your mind on something like that is a lengthy process.
Yeah.
And your 70-something-year-old father is probably less likely to do that than your 30-something brother if he had a similar opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there probably are people, I mean, I'm positive there are people alive today who were segregationists as young adults and who now think that that's wrong today.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about the other Finch male?
Yeah, Uncle Jack.
I think he was a character where Harper Lee was going for a certain thing and just missed it.
Didn't quite work.
He's supposed to be the hilariously head in the clouds academic who I think is supposed to have a way of illuminating things despite not being fully in touch with reality. And he just comes across as a pretentious, puffed up pain in the ass, honestly.
Yeah, Uncle Jack, at first you think, like, okay, he could be kind of charming, but then when Scout tries to have a conversation with him, it's like, yeah, I was like, that part of the book was so infuriating, not because I was raging about his opinions necessarily, but just because his way of talking is so roundabout, and he's referencing all this effing nonsense that seems to have nothing to do with anything else.
Jeez, I was just as frustrated as she was.
I don't get what you're talking about. He's like, use your brain. It's like, why don't you just fucking say something straightforward for once?
Use your brain. Understand my 3 consecutive obscure Victorian literary references, idiot.
Yeah, jeez.
It's like, look here. You just tell me what you're thinking for once.
And then stop talking in circles, Jesus.
Yeah, and I'm going to make a point, and then I'm going to step back because it'll be more fun if Gabs elaborates on it. But when he tries to after her blow up at Atticus, when Uncle Jack tries to. I guess successfully does get her to slow down for a second and actually pay attention. I think having him do that by delivering a slap across the mouth may not have been the best way to do it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she even describes it as like a vicious backhand, which means he just like slaps the ever-loving shit out of her.
Yeah.
Which was one of the most heinous parts of the book to me.
Yeah, it was shocking.
Because I was like, I get that he's, like, trying to get her to listen, but if I was Scout and my uncle just slaps her really, really hard, like, to the point where she actually needs, like, medical treatment, and then he's like, now listen, I just needed you to slow down so I can explain some things about the world to you, because you're a child and I am an adult man who knows better than you. I would be like, fuck you, I'm going to the train station, never talk to me ever again. Like,
paternalism.
And then she ends, like, when she ended the conversation, me like, oh man, I'm really ashamed, I behaved badly. That was one of the parts that pissed me off the most, because I get that the book is trying to get across this point that she shouldn't have seen Atticus in such a shining light, and now she's finally realized, like, he's a messed up person too. But the way it was delivered through Uncle Jack being Uncle Jack just infuriated me, because he was such a condescending douchebag.
He was, and I think, again, like the paternalism thing, there's a reason that word has come to be used in discussions of race and ethnicity and gender, and it happens a couple of times in this book, and you used the one of my favorite actually modern terms, which is mansplaining, when we were talking about it yesterday.
There are multiple men in this book who try to mansplain to Scout, like, the entire book.
Right, yeah.
Like, oh, shut up.
And just, like, if Jack is this academic, and he even makes a point after he smacks her so hard she grays out, right?
Yes.
And he even makes a point after that, oh, I've never hit a woman before, it really takes something out of you. And I'm like, don't play this off as a joke.
Yeah, he's like, oh, I need a drink now that I hit a woman, I'm a little shaken up. I was like, you fucker.
Yeah, that scene, that shit shocked me. That incident shocked me. I did. But like, I was rattled for a second before I could keep reading, honestly.
Yeah, it was very shocking. And I don't even know, like,
when he's supposed to,
like, can you have just, like, grabbed her by the arm and been like, slow down for a second?
Well, he's like this crazy madman academic Finch, right? Because the Finches have this reputation for having a little bit of a crazy streak, and he's supposed to be this really clever academic guy. Like, couldn't you come up with, probably right now, we could come up with 3 or 4 more creative ways to get someone's attention Like, couldn't he have, like, said just the perfect cutting thing that she'd have no choice but to actually listen to? Because he's known her since she was born. If he was gonna... if it had to be something physical, couldn't he have, like, thrown a... couldn't he have asked for a drink of water and then just turned around and thrown it in her face? Like, hey, woman, chill out.
Or I was thinking, like, I don't remember if she had her suitcase with her or not, or just, like, pick her suitcase up and, like, throw it into the yard.
Right. It's just
and be like, calm down for a second.
Something out of the ordinary, like, hey, I'm doing this so you'll actually just stop for 2 seconds and listen to a word or two I am saying.
Or if he just, like, slapped himself as hard as he could.
His glasses go flying off onto the lawn. And she's like, oh, shit.
What are you doing? He's like, well, I couldn't slap you, but I had to get your attention.
You're a woman, but someone here needs their ass kicked, so I'm kicking my own. See, any of these things. Or even could have just taken his cane and wrapped her on the knuckles instead of trying to knock her unconscious.
It was pretty messed up. I'm not okay with it, yeah. I like to say.
Agreed. Totally.
Atticus may be many things that I do not like, but he never hits or yells at his daughter, so
I like to
he does have some good stuff in there.
I like to think that once he's done sorting out his family, getting Scout to acknowledge that they can still love each other despite having this disagreement. I like to think that the next thing he did was go over to Jack's house and explain to him for a long time how it's not okay to backhand his daughter.
Like, hey man, hey, thanks for helping me out, but
remember my
kind of a dick move.
Yeah, remember my wife that you were randomly in love with? She wouldn't have approved. She wouldn't have approved of that.
Yeah, that's the other character revelation, I guess, we get about Uncle Jack, is that he was apparently in love with Scout's mother, which is at the end of the book and completely random and absolutely does nothing to develop anybody's character or shine a new light on anything.
It was like, okay.
It's like, well, by virtue of him not being married or having children, wouldn't you kind of assume that his brother's children would be like children to him, regardless of whether or not he was in love with their mother?
I would think, like, so. In a small town situation like that, especially, yeah.
Yeah, that it didn't surprise me that he was so concerned with helping her, and then at the end he's like, oh, by the way, very important that you know I used to be in love with your mother. And I was like, that just makes me dislike you even more.
Yeah, take your filthy eyes off of my mother.
I'm still in love with your mother. It's like, dude, stop being a Snape. Get over yourself, please.
Everybody go check out the Minerva talk about Snape, by the way. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes. So, we have a couple more characters to touch on.
Yes.
Actually, before we do, I meant to ask, I don't remember Uncle Jack from To Kill a Mockingbird. Was he even in it?
I do not remember him either. And by virtue of Scout saying that he, like, was often where Birmingham or something before he retired, I would assume that during To Kill a Mockingbird he was
his medical
off
practice
in the city doing his thing before he came back? Question mark?
Maybe. Alright, fair enough.
I don't remember him either. I remember Alexandra. I don't remember Uncle Jack, so maybe he's one of those characters that Harper Lee was like, you know what, he doesn't need to be in these books.
Yeah. there's this dude, Hank.
Yes.
Who is basically an orphaned puppy. And I cannot come up with a compelling reason to care about him.
Yeah, Ben didn't even want to talk about him. He's like, I just don't even care about this guy.
I straight up do not care about Hank, even a little bit.
I think it's one of the failings of the book. So I guess another spoiler alert is that we find out at the beginning of the book that Jem, her brother, has dropped dead several years ago. So Jem's not in the book except in a couple of flashbacks. And I think Hank is kind of filling the Jem gap, clearly, like, Jem would not be in love with his own sister, but, you know, kind of, like, that same age of guy that she's interacting with. But because we don't know anything about him, and he just shows up in this book, and he's just, like, bland love interest man that if you were watching a movie and this guy showed up, you'd be like, ha, she's never going to end up with that guy.
Right.
he's kind of cute, but there's no fucking way she's going to end up with that guy. That's Hank.
I think Hank is there just so Scout's she's not one of these, but she maybe has some tendencies in that direction depending on who you are, but he exists so she can show off her manic pixie dream girl tendencies on the one date.
Hey. She's not a manic pixie type.
I said I said she wasn't. That was my caveat.
from Hank's perspective, maybe.
Yeah.
Because the whole manic pixie dream girl thing is that, like, she doesn't have an inner life, and her whole purpose is to, like, help a man realize something.
Right.
And clearly, Scout has an inner life.
Right.
But Hank seems to want her to just be, like, good wife lady. So maybe, like, he's trying to make her into one of those.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, because Hank's whole thing is he's like, let's get married. And she's like, I don't know. And then we find out, so, you know, he also is at the segregationist meetings, and we find out at the end that he's not so much pro-segregationist, but he's trying so hard to fit into the town because he kind of comes from, like, a, what they consider, like, a lower stock of person. You know, his family was not held in high regard. They were considered trashy, so he's been trying so hard to build himself up that he's going to these meetings because that will do more for him than trying to speak out against the meetings. So he's kind of taking the coward's route of doing what works for him as opposed to following his morals.
Yeah, I mean, he's a... I don't know. I don't care. It's Hank.
Ben's like, I don't even care about that. Whatever.
I can't muster up the energy.
Well, I think that's the reason Hank's in the book, is he's kind of showing the other side of racism in the South, is that not everyone was necessarily pro everything that was going on, but they just weren't willing to speak up against it. And that's, like, in and of itself its own form of cowardice, so.
Right, yeah.
And maybe that's why you don't like him. It's just because, hey, he doesn't have a spine. He just kind of sucks. Whatever.
He does. He doesn't have anything interesting to say either.
Yeah.
He's... this.
And actually... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, he's... since one of our favorite topics is how to adapt literary works into a college comedy, he'd be the character that every time he speaks up, everyone's just like, what, Hank? He'd be like, what about this? And they'd be like, what about this, Hank?
Rolling their eyes. Shut up, Hank.
Sorry, guys.
I was going to say, the other scene with Hank, so the whole flashback with, like, the dance, the high school dance, was really funny. But I did think it was... So Scout is wearing, like, false
bosom.
Skis, like false boobs, basically, to give her a little bit more of a womanly figure. But then they don't get sewn into her dress, so they end up, like, shifting during the night, and Hank notices and, like, takes her outside to be like, Scout, you need to readjust your boobs. And he's like, why don't you just not wear them? And then he reaches into her dress and grabs them out and throws them. And I was like, this is all funny, but I am kind of disturbed by him, like, grabbing them out of her actual bra. Like, couldn't she have pulled them out to replace them, and then he grabs them from her hands? Like, I don't know how I feel about this.
I pictured him doing it so quickly that they were both kind of startled by it, and maybe he didn't even... Because that's the kind of thing that a teenage guy might not realize he was doing until after he'd already done it.
He's like, oh, crap. Put my hands down your dress. Whoops.
It's like, I'm just going to gloss over that so we don't have to talk about it.
Yeah, that was the, like, and I wasn't horribly bothered by it, but I was kind of like, that was kind of awkward.
It was kind of awkward, yes.
All right, well, we can move on from Hank.
All right. So, Calpurnia, the black housekeeper, kind of a very much, I would say, a mother figure for Scout when she was growing up, gets a scene.
Yeah, she gets a scene in the present. She has a couple scenes in the past where she helped Scout through things, I think, to kind of give us an idea of how close they were. But then she gets one scene in the present where we find out that Calpurnia's grandson was drunk driving, is that right? And hit a person on the road and killed him. Like a guy who was, like, wandering around the streets, I guess, who was also drunk.
I was going to say,
and so Scout goes to see Calpurnia because she feels really horribly for her and just wants to say, hey. And it's a really interesting scene because it gives you some insight into race relations at the time and how everyone, like, when she shows up at Calpurnia's house, so everyone's manner completely changes because now, like, a white woman is there and they have to act differently. And the real, like, biting moment of the whole thing is she goes in to talk to Calpurnia, and Calpurnia is just, is completely formal with her, and this really bothers Scout because she's used to her being a mother figure to her, and she wants Calpurnia to show that she still loves her, and she won't do it, and Scout is super disturbed by that, that this gap has grown between them.
Yeah.
And
I mean, Calpurnia has her, I mean, it's, one of the things I wondered with that scene was how many people read that scene and thought that Calpurnia was being mean to Scout in that moment.
Yeah. Which is not the point of the scene.
I was going to say, I think it's pretty obvious to people who listen to us that that would not be our opinion on that scene.
Yeah.
But, you know, just that this woman is heartbroken, but that the relationship between the racial divide is such that even though this she was like this mother figure, they can't have, I mean, they can't have this actual family connection. And in this moment of heartbreak because her grandson kind of, I think it, someone even said, like, kind of her favorite, even.
Yeah.
Is probably going to go to jail for a long time now. That, you know, she just, it's not in her in that moment to overlook that grief just so she can make this white girl feel better.
Yeah, and that's what I totally think it's about, is that I think Scout has good intentions, but I think by going over there, she is sort of making it about her, because she's not just going in like, I'm really sorry, and, like, you know, putting her arm around her and trying to help her feel better. She's like, did you love my family? Calpurnia's like, go away.
Right.
Like, my family is having all sorts of issues right now. I don't really care that you're having a moral crisis. I'm sorry. Get out.
Right. And fair enough.
Yeah, totally fair enough.
If the conversation had been, if there's anything I can do, let me help, and then nothing about, weren't we family growing up, what about me?
Yeah.
Like, the first, it started in a place like, well, maybe, but, yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, and I also just think, you know, at that point, Scout hasn't really realized the intensity of segregation and what's been going on in her hometown. And I think at that point, you know, no matter what Calpurnia feels for Scout, like, the race relations have been getting so bad that she can't necessarily overcome all this other stuff that's been going on to just be nice to her. So, yep. It's also, I think, just a good overall demonstration of how segregation, I'm going to say something about stuff that I've read where, like, pre-segregation clearly, like, black people who still did not have all the rights that they should have, and there's a lot of bad stuff going on. But one of the interesting things that I've read is, like, the race relations were better because they, like, white and black people interacted on a daily basis all the time. And then once segregation kind of got kicked into place and everyone got separated, then even though, like, no one's status had really changed, the relationships changed because white and black people didn't interact all the time anymore because they did everything separately. And so it actually, like, opened up this big gap where then they had a hard time, like, being able to relate or empathize with each other because they didn't see each other anymore. So there's, you know, been this huge, like, gap in society opening up on top of all this other stuff. And I think that is just, you know, well, I don't see you all the time anymore, and now I'm forced to, like, go do all this shit across town, and why am I supposed to still like you?
Right. Well, that makes, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I think that ties into modern stories of racist encounters and such that people have, you know, especially, you know, like the cliche idea of when someone's walking down the sidewalk and they see the black man coming down the sidewalk, they cross the street or something, right?
Yeah.
Just the idea of, oh, well, we never see, you know, in our usual neighborhoods, even today, it certainly exists, if not by policy, then maybe by tradition and momentum. And Kansas City is actually one of the worst cities for this, I think. Like,
yeah.
But a lot of the neighborhoods where lots of white people live don't have black people living in them, and vice versa. So it's essentially segregated in some places,
yeah,
in some neighborhoods. And it's true, like, you're going to be more likely to fear or to have distaste for a group of people that you never actually see or talk to.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
So, since we seem to be pretty far down the track, why don't we add any leftover ideas about racism we have on our outline here?
Okay, yeah. So I just like everyone to know that yesterday when we were outlining, I was raging a lot harder about racism, but now I guess that I got a lot of that out, I've been a little able to be a little less vitriolic about it. But just so you know, I'm quite angry at Atticus and want to punch him in his dumb face for all the shit that he says. And the other thing that I wanted to bring up is that in the conversation Scout has with her Uncle Jack, before she goes and talks to Atticus, he's blabbing on about all this nonsense. And one of the things that he starts talking about is the Civil War, which is every Southerner's favorite topic, about how they didn't go to war for slavery. And he makes this claim that how could they have gone to war for slavery? 5% of people, like, less than 5% of people in the South even owned slaves or ever saw slaves on a regular basis, so there's no way that they were all joining the army and going to war for slavery. And I was like, that rings like pure bullshit to me. I have taken classes on the antebellum South, and I was like, pretty sure it's not what we talked about in class, so I decided to, like, actually do a little bit of research for, like, the first time in the history of novel ideas. And I went and looked up some facts that I would like to share with you. So his claim that 5% of people owned slaves is not even true when you consider the U.S. as a whole, which included non-slave owning states. So only 8% of all U.S. families owned slaves, including all of the non-slave states. But focusing directly on the South, which are the slave owners, 33% of families owned slaves. So it's one-third of families that owned slaves. There was a big divide, like the big plantations with like 100 slaves that people think about. That was very few families, but a lot of people owned 10 or fewer. So you still have a third of people owning other human beings, which is a lot. The other number that I brought, or the other thing that I brought up, was research by historian Joseph Glasser. I don't know if that's how you say his last name, I apologize. But he was looking at soldiers in the Confederate Army in Virginia. And he said that in 1861, the people who volunteered for the Confederate Army, almost one of every two recruits were from slave-owning families, which means about 50% of them who volunteered owned slaves directly. And then he added, untold numbers of enlistees rented land from, sold crops to, or worked for slaveholders. In the final tabulation, the vast majority of volunteers of 1861 had a direct connection to slavery. So even though only one-third of people owned slaves, about half of the volunteers owned slaves, and the other half benefited enough from slavery that they wanted to try to protect it. So this nonsense claim that people still trot out today, that as a historian, makes me, flames on the side of my face, like, fucking get over yourself, they were trying to protect slavery. Okay.
Right.
So angry.
All right. So, as long as you're still angry, you want to talk about feminism in this book?
Yes, I would love to feminist Hulk out. So, I mean, racism is really, like, the big, like, set. Front and center issue going on in this book, clearly. It's the entire second half is Scout freaking out about it. But there is another thing going on here, feminism, as you always expect me to talk about. So there's really no other women. I mean, there's Scout and Aunt Alexandra, who's kind of, like we already said, like typical Southern lady. But other than that, Scout has really no meaningful conversations or connections with any other women in the book, even in her flashbacks. And we get this one chapter where Aunt Alexandra hosts a coffee where all the ladies come in to chat and see what Scout's up to, and so she can see what they're up to. And it's super, like, oh, you know, the women with the babies are talking about their babies, and the married women are talking about their husbands, and then, like, the three loser spinsters who haven't gotten married yet are, like, sequestered in a corner by themselves, and Scout doesn't know how to talk to any of them, and it's super awkward, and it just, like, reeks of Scout's the cool girl, and so she doesn't fit in with women, because women are losers who just gossip about men babies. And I was like,
Yeah, well, it was even like, it was, and those, like, types of lady conversations are so cliche that even in the scene where the tea is happening, it's like little forward snippets, like a stream of consciousness is like, oh, there's this, dot, 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 this, dot, 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 this, and it's just like a couple pages of little fragments of cliche lady talk.
Yeah, it's like, oh, little Jack finally learned how to walk, dot, dot, dot. They say the best way to potty train, dot, 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 like when the women are talking about their kids. Yeah.
My bill does this, dot, dot, dot. Yeah, Chuck's also put on 20 pounds since we got married, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, then there's the whole, like, ha-ha, men get fat when they get married because everyone's miserable when they get married.
Burp, burp, burp.
Burp, 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 burp. I was just like, God. And I still like Scout, and it just really frustrates me because, like, as a woman myself, I value my female friendships a lot. And we talk about a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with being married and babies.
And yeah.
as a married person, I like to think that I am not some effing married loser who can only talk about married people shit. So just really, for both of those things just really frustrated me. And I really wish that there was, like, some other woman in this book that Scout could talk to and You know, like, even if she was like, oh yeah, like, my great girlfriend's back home, I really miss them, then that might be like a condemnation of the South that she just can't get along with Southern ladies or whatever nonsense. But, I mean, there's just like, no, it's all of her big interactions are mostly with men, and I just think that's super frustrating and annoying.
Well, yeah, because you have a sophisticated and complex and interesting woman protagonist, and written by a woman author, it does give you cause to wonder where the other interesting women are.
Yeah.
Because
surely Scout's not the only woman in all of Maycomb who's interesting.
There's got to be one more, right? I mean, Atticus was married to a woman.
Yeah.
Presumably he wouldn't have married some drone who would only talk about how Atticus had gained weight since they got married and baby stuff.
Yeah. You would think.
Okay, shall we try to push down the stretch here?
Yes. So, the big theme in this book, which I think we already talked about, is the really big idea is that you, as an adult, you have to grow your own moral compass and your own conscience and realize that people that you grew up around, who you maybe even admired, might have different opinions than you, and at some point you have to say, you know what, this is what I believe, and I'm not just going to like hitch my wagon to yours and believe what you believe because I look up to you, and you have to learn how to stand up for yourself is basically what's going on here.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of, I guess, the, you know, because To Kill a Mockingbird was a lot about protecting innocence, I think.
Yeah.
And this book has some undertones of the idea of innocence. I think I'm getting that a lot from the flashback scenes as much as anything, but Scout is kind of an innocent type of character, and that's why it's so shattering when her dad says something that she thinks is morally wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a little bit of that in there, and just, like, becoming, you know, growing up, becoming an adult.
Yeah, and hitting that point everyone hits at some point as they grow up where they go, oh crap, my parents are people too.
Right,
that
yeah.
That sucks.
It has moments where it sucks.
Yeah.
For sure.
There's a
give and take to that that I don't think this book was trying to capture everything. It was really trying to capture that moment where you realize that your parents are imperfect. But I'll say on the flip side of that, in real life at least, that when they become people and you can talk to them and find out that they're actually like interesting people and not just these monolithic figures, that's the good side of that as well.
Yeah, and also that like you can become a person to them too instead of just like something they have to take care of. So,
right, exactly.
Everyone just eventually becomes people, and people are complicated and it sucks sometimes, and that's just kind of what life is about.
And that's why racism is bad.
Everyone's people. Yeah, I will say that even though Harper Lee, like, you know, goes to lengths to make sure that, you know, Atticus isn't completely villainized, I think she's still making the point, like, that I think she's on Scout's side, let's say, that Atticus is wrong to think these racist things. But that's just, like, how the South goes.
Right. Yeah, because I think you could put a spin on this story, which I don't think she does, but I think you could put a spin on it where the goal would become to say, racism is bad, let's condemn the South's attitudes on this. I think she's very carefully saying, racism is bad, but let's not make that a blanket condemnation of the South.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, strengths and weaknesses of the writing.
We've touched on several of that these ideas already, I think, but it is in need of editing in places, and not just the kind of editing where it needs to be cut down. There are probably some things that could be expanded on as well.
It's actually a pretty short book.
It really is, yeah. And partly because it's short, and partly because nothing really happens until the second half of the book, there's not a whole hell of a lot of plot in there.
No.
I already had mentioned earlier that Scout being shocked over this meeting that her father and, at least in a semi-serious way, potential future husband were sitting in on was, like, her shock over that did get tedious. It wasn't... It needed work.
It did. I think, with what we were talking about, the main failing of the book is that without To Kill a Mockingbird, I don't think anyone would actually care about what was happening in the book. And for that same reason, like, because we have To Kill a Mockingbird, Scout's shock about all this stuff is like, well, didn't you kind of know some of this already? Like, it feels disingenuous at times that she's, like, so thrown off by it because... we know she already learned about some of this when she was a kid.
Yeah, because without the trial scene from To Kill a Mockingbird, then her shock at Atticus being at this meeting doesn't really have any context.
Yeah, if you just read Ghost at a Watchman and hadn't read To Kill a Mockingbird and got to that point where she was reeling about Atticus, you'd kind of be like, oh, well, okay, but... I mean...
Yeah, we only have your
word
for it.
Why are you that surprised?
Right.
But then because we have To Kill a Mockingbird, then everyone's surprised.
Right. You would say, why do... we only have your word for it that Atticus is this person you say he is. So,
mm-hmm.
So the shock to me wouldn't be all that deep. And, you know, I finished the book, and I set it down, and then I... like, the very first thought that popped into my head was, would I... give two shits about this book if I didn't know To Kill a Mockingbird?
Yeah, I did the exact same thing. I was like, would I care that Jem died if I hadn't read a book starring him, like, with him in it already?
Right.
Probably not. I think Dill was only thrown in there because Dill's in To Kill a Mockingbird, so you're like, oh, Dill, okay. But otherwise, you'd just be like, why are you reminiscing about this random guy you knew in your childhood for one scene?
Right, it wouldn't make any sense. And, you know, those flashbacks, you can see why the publisher would say, hey, we're not sure about this book, but those flashbacks were really interesting. Can we hear more about Scout's childhood? Because the scene with Dill, where the three of them were... it seems like they were playing baptism as a pretend game.
Yes,
and so,
I think so.
Dill's running around the neighborhood stark naked as a result of this. and that's funny and charming. And her getting kissed on the mouth by a guy and then being convinced she's pregnant for, like, the next year.
Yeah.
is just... It's ridiculous and it's silly, but it's growing up stuff. It's interesting. You do want to hear more about that, and so
mm-hmm.
I mean, there are flashes and moments of really good stuff in here. It's just not tied together very coherently, I think.
Yeah, I think it reads like a first draft of a first novel, and that. It shows promise, which is probably why they asked her to write To Kill a Mockingbird, but in and of itself, it's not a great book.
Yeah, agreed. So a couple of other questions we had aside from why do we care about this?
Yeah, and these questions are what led us to believe maybe it's not quite the same timeline, because my question was, where the heck is Boo Radley? Like, she doesn't even mention him.
Yeah, because he was such an important, like, this legendary character when she was a kid.
Yeah, you think she'd be at least like, oh yeah, that one time when Boo Radley, like, saved my life from a guy killing me.
Right.
That's kind of important.
Are these really the same characters? Also, one of the things that we haven't mentioned yet, I think, is that her relatively brief reference to the trial in this book, she talked about Tom having been acquitted.
Yes.
Which was most...
It was the first time that it ever happened.
Yeah, which was most certainly not the case in To Kill a Mockingbird.
I think more realistically it was not the case in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes, agreed. And that's part of what makes that scene so powerful in To Kill a Mockingbird is because justice is clearly on the side of this guy, but law turns out not to be.
Yeah.
I think it's... You've probably gathered that our opinion on this book is kind of meh.
Yeah. If you read it, you will be completely enraged by Atticus's arguments.
Yes.
And want to throw your book across the room, for sure.
Don't do that if you're reading it on your phone, like I did.
I had an actual copy, so...
So, what are you reading right now?
Well, I actually just finished Skin Game by Jim Butcher, which I looked up is the 15th book in the Dresden Files. Holy cow, there's a lot of books in that series.
I've read all of them.
And I read Skin Game for a special Hugo review thing we're doing for Minerva. And I read it because I hadn't read any of the Dresden books, and we thought it'd be interesting to see if it still made sense if I hadn't read any of the other ones. So you'll have to wait to hear what I think about it till you read my review.
That's right. And in that same line of reasoning, I just have recently finished Ancillary Justice and Ancillary Sword by Anne Leckie. The first two books in a space operatic trilogy that has a lot of really interesting stuff going on in the background of that universe, and I am also going to be reviewing Ancillary Sword, the more recent book, as it is a Hugo nominee this year too, and then I have started reading The Moral Arc by Michael Shermer, which is, I've really barely started. I'll probably be reading it for like the next 3 months because it's kind of a monster, but it at least advertises itself as how reason and knowledge have actually improved our morality over time. So, we'll see. It sounds interesting.
All right.
So, if you have any comments, questions, opinions, trivia, etc. that you want to share with us, you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can tweet the podcast at novelideaspod, or you can tweet me directly at classicsumup.
Yes, we are also on iTunes, where you can rate, review, comment. I gather that helps people find this silly thing.
And we actually finally, I think, have like a logo on iTunes, which is very special.
That's good.
And because we are officially part of the Minerva Podcast Network, you can also find us on the Minerva website at www.minervamag.com, where we also have three other podcasts. So if you like me, at least, I appear on some of those, so you can go check those out on the website.
Yeah, and definitely read the stuff they're posting. If you are of a geeky bent, but also I think if you just like to read intelligent opinions with at least somewhat of a maybe equality-oriented slant, more than feminist even.
Yes.
It's good stuff. I enjoy it, and I'm not part of the staff, even though I occasionally write stuff for them. So, I like
it.
I like it, at least. not sure exactly what we'll be bringing you next time, but we perhaps will post something about that on the Novel Ideas website and tweet it out, so you have a little time to do reading if you want to do that.
Yes, we are looking at maybe some banned books, and we are looking at some science fiction and YA written by people of color, so...
So that'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it. I'm ready to go on a Harper Lee is not a man, but I'm still ready to go on a non-white dude kick here.
Yes.
So that's gonna do it this time, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Tax. How I love you. How I love you, my dear old.